If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is Don Finelli. Before we start today's show, I just have to tell you about an incredible new podcast available right here on the Forever Dog Network. It's called The Angel of Vine. The Angel of Vine is an audio drama that is perfect for fans of true crime, film noir, and old Hollywood. It stars, get ready, Joe Manganiello, Constance Zimmer, Alan Tudyk, Camilla Luddington, Mike Colter, Misha Collins, Cary Payton, and Alfred Molina. That's right, Doc Ock himself. Alfred Molina is on the podcast. So what's The Angel of Vine about? It tells the story of a present-day journalist who uncovers the audio tapes of a 1950s private eye who cracked the greatest unsolved murder mystery Hollywood has ever known and didn't tell a soul. It's like Serial meets the Black Dahlia. Making a Murderer meets LA Confidential. And once you start listening, you won't be able to stop. New episodes every Wednesday until the thrilling conclusion on January 16th. So subscribe to The Angel of Vine right now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And if you want even more The Angel of Vine, you can get exclusive access to advanced episodes, ad-free episodes, and bonus episodes on Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/angel and using promo code ANGEL. Last but not least, stay tuned at the end of this episode for an exclusive clip from The Angel of Vine. All right, let's get on with the show.
Forever Dog.
This episode of The Need to Fail is brought to you by refrigerators. Milk, vegetables, leftovers. Refrigerators keep perishable items preserved for days using patented thermodynamic technology. Now we don't have to add a ton of salt to our food to add longevity, even though we still do. Or naturally preserve our food with fermentation, which is vital to replenishing our gut bacteria. Anyway, refrigerators, damn, they keep stuff cold.
Sometimes you need to fail. The Need to Fail.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to The Need to Fail. My name is Don Finelli. I run this thing. Oh, God, I'm going to sneeze. Goddamn wildfires. I'm so close to 150 rates and reviews for my podcast, guys. If you have a chance and you haven't done so already, rate the show right on your phone. It takes 2 seconds. If you dig the podcast, please tell people about it and then rate it. And if you have some extra time, if you're motivated to do so, why not write a review? Every little bit helps, guys. Let's get this baby to 150 by the end of the year. Come on. You know, I've been having some long intros lately. I say we keep this one short and sweet. I'll just tell you about a recent failure of mine, which is I've just been reading much slower and with much less frequency lately. That's it. Especially this year, it feels like all the things that have worked in my past for like mental, spiritual, physical health, I've just kind of revolted against this year. I'm trying to get to the bottom of it, but yeah, it's this overall like macro failure, like reading, journaling, meditating, planning. I just started losing hope in their effectiveness. But as Josh Brolin's character Bran says in The Goonies, at the bottom of the well, what about my dreams, my wish? Well, I'm taking them back. I'm taking them all back. I mean, when I was writing this down, it made sense, but I don't think that makes sense for what I was talking about. I'm taking, whatever. Now this fucking intro is long. It's a powerful scene in The Goonies nonetheless. Well done, Chris Columbus, the screenwriter, not the Native American killer. All right, let's just get to our show. I had such a fun conversation about a very serious subject. I feel like my guest is kind of one of the few people that can pull this off with ease. We have the grown-up little boy we now know as Craig Rowan on today. Craig has written for shows like Search Party, At Midnight, Jack and Triumph Show. He wrote and acted for Wet Hot American Summer 10 Years Later and Adult Swim's Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell. He also ran a pretty famous internet campaign, Please Give Me $1 Million, a couple of years ago. You can check that out online. And he has a podcast that he had for a long time that's back up that I had the privilege of being on. It's called It's That Episode. You watch one of your favorite episodes of television, then you talk about it. I, of course, chose Captain Planet. I believe it was the pilot episode. I've known Craig through the UCB Theater for many years. He was on my mod team, Gramps, but before I got on. So we didn't overlap there, except for our final show. He came back. But I used to watch him all the time on Harold Night and rise through the ranks of the theater. Eventually got to do some ass cats with him, get on stage with him. He's just one of the most fun people to play with. I think he's like a ninja at reacting to the absurd, but also just being able to, like, has a great ability to move things forward in that fun place within that reality. I don't know. He's good. And I really appreciate him coming on and, talking about something that he hasn't publicly talked about ever. It was when he moved to LA a couple of years ago, this kind of perfect storm of stress, anxiety, undiagnosed blood sugar issues, and weed led to this kind of 3-day psychotic episode, which landed him in a hospital for a week. And then later he was diagnosed with diabetes. I just think there's this stigma against, you know, talking about mental health, obviously, but especially amongst men, which, you know, I think can lead to all sorts of violence and other crazy shit. And I think Craig just does a great job giving an honest and detailed account of a very extremely, you know, scary time in his life. And he winds up finding the humor throughout. Call me out on my stupidities. My big failure was having a goddamn delivery guy interrupt the episode by creepily standing outside my window, like tapping on it as Craig is like pouring his heart out. But so two things you should know about that. I don't order out a lot. I cook most nights, but I was out all day and I couldn't. I guess I'm just naive to seamless, and I don't understand the fragility that is online food ordering. But I ordered the food to arrive at a certain time that most likely the podcast would be over, and if it wasn't, my wife would be home to feel the goddamn thing. But I should have known that time estimates are never accurate. They were like an hour early. I'm a big dummy. Let's get to it, though. Craig's the best. He's hilarious. He does something really uncomfortable here. I really appreciate him doing this. So I know you will too. Here he is, Craig Rowan.
I've never talked about this stuff publicly.
Yeah.
So I've talked it to people, yeah, but in a public forum, even though this is private, but it, yeah, will be going out public.
Yeah.
So my terminology and things that I talk about, yeah, are probably incorrect and, uh-huh, wrong, but right, I'm talking about my experience.
Gotcha.
So if you have problems with it, go eat a bag of shit. But I just don't know. So people might,
right,
feel like whatever, but this is, yeah, what happened to me, and I'm going to...
This, whatever, is when you moved to Los Angeles for, yeah, the first, yeah, time?
I came to LA for, I thought I was going to move here like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of hoping to, but, mm-hmm, then this job I was doing, I was working here and it didn't end up, it got complicated and I ended up going back to New York. And,
right,
and by complicated, I mean, I fucked up. No, I'm just kidding. It just, there's just
holy
like,
shit,
yeah, I did some bad stuff. No, it's just basically
I
this
killed
job.
Somebody.
Bottom line is I murdered somebody. And like, if that's my experience, so if you have a problem with my terminology, it was homicide. No, but anyway, so I'm, but
so
I
you moved, were working a job so here. You thought you were going to stay here, but then you wound up.
And then
away.
I moved back, or I didn't, my wife is still in New York and I went back to New York and was there for another 2 or 3 years and then came back out here.
Gotcha.
And soon after,
yeah,
we moved here, I went cuckoo bananas.
You went cuckoo bananas.
I went insane.
Was it Los Angeles?
It was a lot of things.
Yeah, so a perfect storm of stuff.
Basically, I had told myself I would never, this is, everybody says this, but I'm not going to move to LA until a job brings me there.
Yeah.
But I was in New York. I was very lucky that I was able to work there for a long,
right,
time. Like,
you're working pretty steadily there.
Patching jobs together. Mm-hmm.
In comedy,
in
writing.
And writing, mm-hmm, things that were what I wanted to be, mm-hmm, doing, but you know, jobs in New York are few and far between.
Right.
I did not ever get hired for a late night show.
Right. So you're submitting for them.
I'm submitting for them. Mm-hmm.
I never got hired, but I never submitted.
I never submitted, and I couldn't figure out what the issue was. And I was like, is there something wrong here? I'm showing up every day, and I'm saying, hire me. No, but I was never hired at those jobs. I was interviewed to write at SNL. I did not get that. Mm-hmm. And then I was working this.
You went in to see Lauren and everything, or just the head writers and stuff?
I said, listen, Lauren. No, I met with the head writers.
Yeah.
And it was the worst job interview I've ever had.
Really?
Were
you nervous or?
Of course I was. But I also like they didn't, I won't, whatever. They didn't make it the most comfortable. Like I figured like I was very happy with my.
It's a mixed bag over there.
Well, I was very happy with my
packet.
Yeah. I thought it was really good. And I got really good feedback from people that I respected. And I sent it in and I got this interview. And then I was like, I'm excited. I know some people who work on the show, and I was like excited because I was like, when you get in there, it's like, they'll just want to talk about comedy and fun stuff. Like, it's like a job interview where it's like, your material is good.
Yeah.
So let's just now like see if it fits.
And first question, sat down. You circumcised?
That was literally it. And I had to show them my penis, and this was 5 years. No. But I had to, their first question was, so what's going on? I was like, what? And I just like flop sweat. I just started sweating. But
what's
so what's up? And I was just like, oh boy. And then it was just me. Like, but anyway, and then there was like a part two of the interview that I, like right after that went really well, that I thought went well, but whatever. Yeah. But I had another. So that was like in the September of whatever.
A couple years ago?
Probably like 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I was concurrently working on this show called the Jack and Triumph Show on Adult Swim, which was Jack McBrayer and Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, which was amazing. But it fell apart while it was happening.
Are you filming also Your Pretty Face at this point?
And then
too?
That is, that's like an ongoing thing. I don't remember.
I forgot when it started. I felt like it was about 4 years ago.
That was like 5 years ago, probably. Mm-hmm. So it was probably had already filmed.
All right, man. I was close.
Dude, it was 4 or 5. But so there were like a bunch of these cool things. But what's it called? Jack and Triumph Show sort of fell apart. Mm-hmm. I had already not gotten SNL, which I thought was like, you know, that's, I'm done with that dream or whatever. Or I'm not going to keep submitting or whatever.
Gotcha.
And then my wife and I are sort of ready to move to LA. We've been talking about it for years, but I had said we wouldn't do it until I got in a job, but our lease was up and I was like, can we get like a 6 month lease extension? And the landlord was like, no,
no,
I was
it's
like
New York. No,
cool.
No, we can do whatever we want. No.
Yeah, exactly. No, you have no rights and fuck you.
You were great tenants. Fuck yourself.
You were so delightful. I'm an old woman, but still fuck you. And, So
you were kind of, it forced your hand a little bit.
Yeah, but we were ready. And it was like, it was time. But I sort of...
And you knew people here, too.
I knew plenty of people here that I had met through the UCB Theater and, you know, the Harold teams and such. Uh-huh. And all my Harold teams, when they broke up, they moved to LA and came together and formed other...
Right, and they just kept a slot open for you.
Yeah, they're just like $12,000 just deserves an open invitation. And we moved out here, and I was like really wanted to get a job, and I was like I was putting a lot of pressure on myself to get a job. My wife moved out, you know, with me because of, you know, she was excited about it, but it's also
she
like
was working in New York.
She's not in comedy. She's she's an illustrator, so she can do it anywhere, but it's like, you know, a big move.
Right.
And our families are in New York. And after like September, October, November, December, so like 3 or 4 months after moving here, and I sort of submitted for a couple jobs, they didn't happen, but I was also going to be going back to the show Your Pretty Face Is Going to Hell, which I act in for Adult Swim, and in like January, but I was putting a lot of my pressure on myself to get a job here, and I was... I will say smoking more dank nugs than I had probably ever before, because for those uninitiated, dank nugs is weed.
Weed. Yeah. Marijuana. Yeah.
And
legal,
because it's legal.
Yeah.
So you can't arrest me.
Yeah.
And also, you know, this is 3 years ago, so try and catch me. There's no evidence. But anyway, I was doing that. I was like smoking weed more. I was putting a lot of pressure
for
on
your
myself.
Anxiety.
For anxiety. Just, yes, whatever. Just like, yeah, I would assume
time
so.
Time to do it too.
And I'm so anxious already that that's not something I should have been doing.
Are you drilling your like managers and agents and stuff like that?
I had like,
by that I mean having sex with them.
Yeah, I was drilling them day and night. This was, you know, this was a couple years ago. So this was acceptable. And
but like you're being like, hey, I'm out here.
Yeah,
now.
Yes, I'm here. And
give me stuff to submit to.
To their credit, they were giving me stuff to submit to, and mm-hmm. I had like interviewed for a couple.
These are TV shows.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And a couple things came and went, and mm-hmm. I was really putting pressure on myself. And then I will also say, within the same year, I'm using the term I went insane or went crazy or whatever, but I basically had, I'm getting to the point that I had a series of manic episodes with like hallucinogenic aspects to it. But right. I should also say that like 6 months later, this was a really bad year for me. I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes.
Right.
And I think there is, I'm still sort of untangling the web, but I think there is a connection that I might have had undiagnosed diabetes too, which meant my blood sugar
was
levels
all over
were
the
going
fucked up.
Down.
Yeah.
And I'm still, again, figuring that out, but I do have a slight bit of documentation that supports that claim.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there was a lot of elements mm-hmm. building up. I was stressed, anxious, work stuff, smoking weed, maybe this blood glucose level thing.
Yeah, and probably.
Probably. And
I'm not a doctor, but then, probably.
And I went to see the newest Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
Uh-huh.
This was 5 Star Wars movies ago.
Just to date this.
Yeah, just to date this. And I went with some friends and I smoked weed. And I would usually do like, I say I smoked a lot of weed, but sort of like small amounts.
Mm-hmm.
And then this time I smoked with someone who smokes a lot more than me. And it was wrapped in some sort of wrap. And it was more than I usually would have. So this also played a role. And basically on the way to the movie, we were in a Uber or in Lyft, a Lyft. And I had this full on freak out.
Oh, geez.
And my wife was with me and I the cab slowed down. I like jumped out and like ran back to the, the apartment. And my wife now says like I was sort of pale, which I think also supports the thing that maybe the diabetes had something to do with this.
Right.
But from then, for like a series of like 3 days, I was on and off going like these crazy manic episode with like hallucinations, paranoia, all this crazy stuff. And
did your friend was he like, yeah, there's PCP in that or something?
No, there was not. I don't believe there was.
Right.
I think that maybe the rap that it was saying,
what he was smoking. Yeah. Yeah,
dog, yo. Dog, yo.
I'm not here to throw my friend under the bus.
I think it was, I know it was in sort of one of those like flavored wraps, which I'm not used to.
Right.
It wasn't.
Yeah, but that's what you're going through.
This is more, this is crazy. So
this is a perfect storm of a lot of things.
Perfect storm of a lot of things. Yeah. And when I say like hallucinogenic, like over the course of the next couple of days, like in my own head,
mm-hmm.
I like experienced the Big Bang.
Okay.
I was like,
you were there, you were watching it.
I was just even like, I feel like when I've heard people talk about like psychedelic drugs, that this is sort of, I like was shivering at one point in the bathroom thinking like Nazis were in the vents.
Holy
like,
fuck.
Really intense stuff.
Did you see these things or was it all feeling stuff? Like, did you have visual stuff?
That's hard to say. I don't.
Yeah, okay.
So your
brain's in and out of it.
I don't know. And like the crazy part is I did two shows at the UCB Theater.
Holy shit. Like, improv shows?
Yeah, because I had like moments of sort of, what's it called? Like clarity or whatever. Yeah.
Lucidity.
No. Yeah. Maybe I think that's right. Yeah. I did this show. Mike still used to host like Bing Crosby's Christmas Spectacular.
Yeah.
And I did I got a lot of laughs. I was on top of it. And then I did an ASCAP the next night. And I was like pretty good for the first half. But then again, my wife said like during the second half, she was at the show. I took my glasses off, which I would never do. I rely on my glasses. And I think I was in my head thinking some weird stuff, and I felt like I needed to have my glasses off. So for the second half, again, this seems really small, but this is like, for me, is very out of the ordinary. But during these days, I mean, my wife was very much helping me out. Like during this, like, we went to, she called 911. The paramedics came. I sort of like refused them. We went to a hospital and they were just like, oh, it's just weed, leave. And during this time, I literally am thinking I am like part of the Mossad and like, am like, I am like, and then like I'm a secret agent.
So
and
you're flying in between.
I'm going, I'm like literally like
spiraling.
Yeah. And I am very much, I would say when I've told friends afterwards, they're like, wow, I would not expect that from anybody, but from you. Like, I'm fairly like,
chill, dude. Yeah.
Pretty chill.
You're pretty chill, dude. But are you freaking out?
Are
you so in and out that you,
what's it called? Like delusions of grandeur were part of it too. So I'm like, it's all good. Like, I remember like basically trying to convince my wife that like in the middle of the night, like, we don't need sleep. Like, why would we need sleep? And like having these like pretty solid arguments of why sleep is unnecessary. And then,
so you were staying up.
I was staying up. I wasn't getting sleep, which was also my sleep leading up to this was getting shorter and shorter. I mean, this, like, even though the weed set it off, I was sort of having super, like, things were leading up to this.
Yeah.
And then like we went to a psychiatrist. He diagnosed me in the room as bipolar. But I mean, I was showing all these signs of like, it's in the DSM or whatever it's called.
And before this, you had never
had anything. I mean, I'd had like weird paranoid highs before, but,
we've all been there.
Hey, bro.
Hey, bro.
But like, no.
But and like no other previously diagnosed, like
nothing. Like mental health. Yeah. Right. Just no mental health issues. And then basically I mean, this is weird to talk. Like, again, I've never talked about this stuff, but like I ended up going to a mental hospital.
Right.
In Los Angeles, in LA.
In Malibu.
It was beautiful. It was the best time of my life. No, but I basically, it turned out like this ended with me, like my parents being called, my parents flying in. I was like stripped myself and was like running onto my, like not roof, but like deck and of the apartment building, like screaming, and the police were called and it was like, I'm, you know,
I think you can hear yourself or someone else.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so I was put in a mental hospital for like a week, I think.
Did you voluntarily go there or do you remember?
I was kicking and screaming and I mean, it was crazy. It was the craziest thing is I was brought into a hospital and this is before the mental hospital, and 6 months later or whatever, when I, maybe 9 months, whenever I was diagnosed for diabetes, I went to the same emergency room, the same exact room. They brought me to the same room that they literally had to like push me down and like,
did they recognize you?
They were all like, hey, man. Hey, you're from Adult Swim, bro. No, they didn't. But like, yeah. So this is, I know the show is called, now I'm forgetting your show.
Oh, this is the best.
The Need to Fail. But I say, when you email me about it, this, I don't find this to be a failure. This is just an experience that was crazy and a part of this, like,
the journey. Well, thank you for kind of opening up about it. I know this is something that's, I'm sure, is maybe uncomfortable to relive or admit, maybe that you're like, yeah, my body did this fucking weird thing. But was there a turning point? Like, when did you start feeling better?
I mean, it took me a really long time. I mean, they put me
how long were you there for?
I think I was there for like 7 days. It was, it was sort of like everybody there was nice, but it was a nightmarish experience. Like, you know, visiting hours were only an hour.
Oh boy.
You know, I'm sleeping on like an uncomfortable bunk bed. I'm confused.
Yeah.
I'm away from my wife and my family, you know,
right.
And it was scary. And I have moments of like, I'm a sane person. I shouldn't be here, but that's not true in this instance. And I am wavering back and forth between like, I'm okay, I'm scared, and then I'm confused, and then like still having these really strange experiences even while I'm there that are like not my normal mental like self. And
right.
So it was really bad. It was really scary. And like in terms of like getting back, like, I mean, I'm still sort of dealing with the repercussions of, like in terms of like mental, I feel I'm doing very well, but
right.
My wife and I still deal with this sort of like, I would say PTSD of it, of like,
yeah.
I think we're sort of coming out of the fog of like being scared that something could happen.
That's what it is. Right.
And, yeah, I'm and sure. like confident,
like this happened. I'm afraid it can happen
yeah,
again.
Yeah. And like, it came out of nowhere. Seemingly, though, looking back, it didn't. It really didn't. But right. realizing, I feel like probably in the last like 6 to 9 months, I've been like, okay, I feel comfortable. But it took a while to really get to that place.
Right. Jen Bartels talked about being diagnosed with type 1
as well,
like adult onset, I guess.
Oh my
is.
God, yeah. That and that was like, was like later in the year, and I'm like.
Hey, everybody, this is the B-Man, old BW from the World Record Podcast, and I'm here to let you know that me and my co-host, the A-Train, a.k.a. Hershey Hellman, took over office hours live this week. We came into the studio. We made it our own. We wrecked the place. I stole one of Tim Heidecker's guitars. So check out Office Hours Live on your podcast app of your choice or at youtube.com/Office Hours Live this week and see what happens. Or go to worldrecordpodcast.com and you can watch the videos or join the Patreon, patreon.com/worldrecordpodcast. Enjoy the show.
It's showtime.
Didn't I just like go through everything? Like,
weren't you guys on a Herald team?
Yeah, dude, $12,000. We transmitted type 1 diabetes to everyone. Don't touch me.
But when she was saying like
someone is at the hey.
Oh, it's food. Ladies and gents, getting dressed doesn't have to be complicated. So let me tell you about Everlane. Everlane makes it really simple. They go to the best ethical factories, they produce premium products, and then they sell them directly to you without traditional markups. Everlane tells you their real costs, so you know you're never overpaying. They want you to know what you're paying for and why. They are radically transparent about every step in their process, and because Everlane sells directly to you, their prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers. Everlane's clothes look better, they cost less, and they last longer. I am currently wearing, no joke, their washed black slim fit jean. And the first time I put these babies on, I was very confused because it felt like I had worn them my whole life. They were soft, they were comfortable, they fit perfectly. Someone knew what they were doing. I also recommend their 365 fleece crew sweatshirt and sweatpants. Like, I never wanted to look good while comfortably lounging, but now I do, and I like it. Also recommend their cashmere crew sweater because I'm just tired of those scratchy wool ones I would get as gifts. The gift of itch. Everlane's timeless essentials are just what you're looking for. No frills, just quality. And right now you can check out our personalized collection at everlane.com/fail. Plus, you'll get free shipping on your first order. That's dope. That's everlane.com/fail. Everlane.com/fail. Sorry, dude.
Let me just explain just what happened. I am bearing my soul. This is really hard. And then a guy with a chin beard shows up
at my window.
At the window.
You're talking about going in and out.
And I'm like, wait a minute. Is this real?
And there's a guy that's banging on her window.
And there's like, I'm like already paranoid.
Oh, jeez, I'm so sorry.
No. I'm so sorry.
It's totally
this
cool.
is perfect for this podcast.
We were talking about type one.
Well,
then,
I'm saying like when she, I think when she was diagnosed and then finally started taking insulin, like things got drastically better
for
her.
My,
was it the same way?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a whole nother story. I mean, I literally was like dying. Yeah. I mean, when I was diagnosed, I was like,
shit was about to shut down.
Dehydrated. Yeah. I was,
your kidneys were fucked.
Peeing all the time. Mm-hmm. I was working and like literally like looked like I lost 20 pounds.
Right.
And I was so stuck. This is also, I think, part of the mental health thing before was like, I didn't see the own my issue. Like right. I've mentioned this on another podcast, but when I was diagnosed, I literally stepped on a scale at a hotel room, was 20 pounds lighter than usual. And my wife was like, oh my God. And I was like, no, the scale's broken. Like that's how stupid I am about my own like body and health and stuff.
Well, cause you have to think like you went through this traumatic experience.
Yeah.
Then it's hard not to think, oh, this is still part of it.
Yes.
Right.
And yeah. And I didn't, even when it happened, I mean, I think there are connections. I don't blame it fully on the, I feel like whatever, there doesn't need to be any blame in general, but I don't pin it all on the diabetes.
Sure.
But yeah, it was like, at this point I was just like, I was just like, too much. This
yeah.
is too much.
Were you like scared? Were you like,
when I was like,
yeah,
diabetic? Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, by the time I was dying, I was for my wife was like, I think you have diabetes. I'm looking up all the symptoms. And I was like, give me a break. No, I don't. And then I was diagnosed, and that was scary because it was like, wait, I was like, what is this? I have to recalibrate my entire life again. Like I had to make
so many.
This is
months after.
This is like 9 months later, and I've already been doing a lot of work on myself to right. be like getting into a place mentally where yeah. I'm like healthy and all this stuff. And now it's like, wait, you also have to change your entire, how you even like do anything, like yeah. how you eat, how you like think about food and health. It's just like my yeah. life now versus 2 years ago is totally different in a good way,
yeah.
in a positive way. But it was like exhausting.
I was going to ask, I mean, this might be a stupid question, but is it?
It is.
It's already a stupid question. But like, when you go through something like this and you're in this hospital, is this something where you're like, you know what? This needed to happen in my life at this point. Like this was a wake up call, or were you like, nope, I didn't need that. I wish that never happened.
I mean, at the time, no. Right. At the time I was like, this sucks. This yeah. is scary for everyone. My family, I'm putting so much on my wife, and like, it was just exhausting. Yeah. But now looking back, and I include my wife when I talk about this a lot because she like did so much.
She
like,
was your rock.
She was really
yeah.
there in so many ways for me. And I feel like we both look back at it as we wish that didn't happen, but we're like thankful in a way that it did, because I feel like we are much more like
grateful.
We're just healthier. We're like,
yeah,
in,
right.
in like, we just are, I think, look at things. We're still deal, you know, you deal with all the bullshit of yeah. life, but I feel like I'm
the perspective
working
is
on
bit.
Being like better to myself yeah, in general
sure.
and not putting as much,
because you know what you went through and you don't oh, want to yeah. do that again.
Oh,
so it's a good motivator. To,
yes.
To be
and
like,
it also, the other thing I learned is like our brains are super fragile. Like
yeah.
I don't, it puts things in perspective of like when you see other people that are dealing with crazy stuff and you're like, that could be me. That
yeah.
like that any experience, like soon after it happened, one of the things, like I got this short-term job working on an award show, mm-hmm. and that made me feel, it was like the first thing where, then this was probably like 4 weeks after this all happened, which was very quick, and mm-hmm. I was like really nervous about
right.
going. And anyway, people were, and I mentioned it to one or two people who were working on it, and they were very nice. And as we were walking on the street after the show, we saw this sort of like homeless man who was sort of talking to himself, sort of like screaming. And she was saying like, oh, we tell, I think it was her kid or her nephew or something. Like when we see people like that, that person just doesn't have the medicine they need.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I feel like that's
right.
Like this sort of how I think about things is like people just don't have access to this mental, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
There's
the help that they need.
Yeah. So it's, I feel like I'm very fortunate that I was able to get that help and have the support system of family.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And when you're, I mean, this stuff is such a stigma to talk about.
Yes. Yeah.
It's such like a thing where we go like, you could have easily just brushed this under the rug and said, hey, you know what? But it, I think it's, I mean, hopefully it's healthy to talk about, or you feel good talking about it, because this, this industry, this world, I mean, it could drive you fucking, it can drive you to places where you're not ready to go sometimes. And I think there's this stigma of getting help as well. Or feeling like you need to do it all alone, which you said, this took your family, this took your wife. You know what I mean? And reaching out and having that support system, I think, is helpful. I think when you come out to LA, I feel it's so isolating here. So it's really trying to rely on those people.
I wasn't really ready for that, like that, my support system. And a lot of my best, closest friends are from college, and now they're a little bit more dispersed, but they're mostly in New York. And I feel like I was unmoored from that. Mm-hmm. And this might sound sort of silly, but like I wasn't doing a regular improv show. I didn't have like an outlet for like like having something like, I feel like doing shows or something is just like a creative outlet. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have these things that I was used to. And you were saying about the stigma of it. I've been very lucky, or I feel like people in the comedy world, when I've brought it up in a couple of rooms, mm-hmm. writer's rooms, and brought it up to people that I know through comedy, and everybody has been really supportive. And I feel like it's nice that I feel like we came up in a world where this stuff is really like not talked about, and like therapy is like scary and all this stuff. Like, I don't need that.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. And then you realize like, pretty much whenever I mention it, people are like, oh yeah, I had this happen to me. Mm-hmm. I had my version of a nervous breakdown. I deal with this and
I
that.
Think specifically with men too. Yeah. It's like, we really want to protect ourselves. Yeah, yeah. And we, especially in this industry, you don't want anybody thinking you're different. But the paradox of that is like, your uniqueness makes you helpful in a room.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
well, yeah,
so like your experiences and all that stuff. But men, I think specifically, and women too. I'm just speaking for men.
He's
the man, man. But I think there's a big stigma for men to talk about mental health. Yeah. And you know, you have to like, you skin your knee, you brush it off, you move forward. There's some aspect, you know, there's some truth to that. But when you're playing up here, when you're playing in your noggin, all bets are off sometimes. Like, you really do need to talk to someone. I think it's gripping stuff. Like, and the more you grip and want, the more anxiety, pressure, all this stuff. And it can really come to a head.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, it's kind of being able to get your support system, talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, just bitch about it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I
know we chose this work.
Yeah, I know.
It doesn't think mean it's not hard.
It's just hard. Well, what I've come to realize about this industry is that we're not only at least me, and I feel like most of the people that we know, you're not only whatever you want to call yourself, a comedian or a writer or an actor, but you're your own boss too.
Yes.
Like, you are a entrepreneur, which I don't think we think about.
Right.
And like,
you're in charge of your own business.
And I'm not good at that. Like, don't think of myself as that. Yeah. And there are aspects of it that are scary. And like even talking about this, it's like, I don't know, maybe this is bad. Maybe like I shouldn't be talking about like future employers. Like, yeah, but whatever. I feel okay about that. But it's like, you are dealing with on a daily basis, like multiple layers of what you do.
Right.
And you also, you're your own boss and employer, so you can an employee, and so you're beating yourself up on every end constantly, and you don't have anyone to say good job, or bad job, or whatever.
It's
and
just
so
Dante's inferno inside of you,
So all day, every day, you are constantly being like, you should be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that, and beating yourself up. And it's like, that's why whenever I'm like working on a job, I feel beyond the having a financial like security of in a sense, like this thing of like, oh, someone is telling me what to do, and that feels good.
Yeah,
like,
right.
There is somebody.
I can do that.
Yeah, like somebody, like, oh, you want me to do like a lot of things? Sure. And then you'll say when I'm done that I've done it. Great. Like, that's all I need is someone who's not me to be like, here,
you should be doing this now
specifically, right. And I'm happy. And I feel like we put a lot of pressure on ourselves because there's no end to it. And what I've realized is that, like, it still happens, of course, yep. But I used to blur, like, because we're our own bosses. I used to always feel like, am I working now? I might be working now. Yeah. Even on the weekends, I'm now I'm much better at like being like, this is my morning. This is when my day starts. This is when I don't have a job. Like, this is when my day stops and this is when my day ends. Mm. And sometimes there are obviously like,
sure,
whatever exceptions, up. But yeah. Like, I needed to do that because I feel like we can get, I don't know about you, but like getting this mindset.
Oh yeah.
You just crossed your eyes.
I big time crossed my eyes.
Because it's like, you're like, I should be doing something now.
All the time.
You need to give yourself a break.
So are you then planning out your days or no? Or you just know that like, I'm going to work from about 9 to 4 yeah, or something
I generally have like, well, now my big thing is exercising in the morning is like, whether that's like walking my dog for a couple miles or I bought a bike and I'm biking now, but like,
well, this was going to ask you like, how do you get over this?
This is a biking podcast, right? So basically what I do,
how does it work?
So basically I start with training wheels. Uh-huh. But I treat my morning, like this is my morning where I do stuff for myself.
Right.
I, like,
you a have part, a routine.
Yeah. And I mm-hmm. have like a routine mm-hmm. and then I'm like from 10 to like six-ish, like I give myself like, this is my assignment for the day. Mm-hmm. And then I've also been better at like, if I've been at my computer for 3 hours and haven't either done it or like, I try to do the work.
Right.
But then at a certain point, if I'm like, this day isn't working out, I'm like, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Like realizing like,
oh yeah,
I'd rather be okay with, I try to still keep within my self, given like, what's it called? Assignments. Mm-hmm. But if I'm like, my head's not in this right now, I can't deal with it.
Like, you know yourself enough and you won't beat the shit out of yourself. Exactly. If you stop.
Like, just stop. Just stop. Like, you can't.
If you can always go back.
Yeah. And it's not like fun to sit at a computer, like going to Twitter or whatever and being like, I should be working. Yeah. It's just like, just do Twitter, waste your whole day. I don't know. Like, at least like you're not beating yourself up anymore. Right. Watch YouTube videos and like, and treat it as research or whatever, like be like, this is, I'm going to watch these videos and hopefully something will come from this rather than like, why am I not working?
Yeah.
I'm an idiot.
Yeah. Cause I mean, we get to these places where we're in creative funks or mental funks or physical funks. And I go like, well, what do you turn to? So it's exercise, planning out your day a little bit, but you're not actually writing it down. You don't have like a weekly planner or anything like that. Or you just have like a mental list of,
I have like a mental projects list, but I've realized when I don't do like, I don't schedule out my week, but I'll be like, this week I'm working on, I've got like a handful of things I'm working on independently.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this, maybe on Monday and Tuesday I'll work on this thing. Mm-hmm. And Wednesday and Thursday I'll work on this thing.
Right.
And like,
so you have a loose outline.
I have a loose outline. And then, but I've realized that when I have written things down, there are, I don't know, I feel this seems Oprah-ish, but like, like when I have written things down,
I almost did an Oprah impersonation.
Oh, please!
And then I stopped.
Please.
Nope. It just. I was gonna be like, "Tell me." Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, that was.
That's really good. Hey, it was both worth it to do it and worth it to stop and say you were gonna do it.
But, please continue.
But
the worst.
I've realized like, even if it's not like even if I'll just put down words like, this is a goal that I'll have,
right,
I'll totally forget about it. And then I'll look back at a notebook and I'll be like, hey, like a year later, like I did that thing that I wrote down. And it's not like I did it because I wrote it down, but it's nice to see little, reminders of like what your goals were and not like to be beholden to it, but more mm-hmm. of like, I also just like general have been trying to keep notes more in general just to see where my thought process was at.
Some would argue that putting it down and putting it out there is probably the very thing that eventually gets it to you. I think there's two schools of thought with it. Some, and I'm in between both, which is always great. Not choosing one. Yeah. Always great. Which is like, do you write your goals down and look at them every day just to kind of motivate you and just kind of keep your focus? Or do you write them down and forget about them? Because if you look at them every day, it's almost like you're desperate for them. And desperation is like a turnoff for the universe.
For God.
For God. For Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is looking at us and controlling our life.
Latter-day Saints.
Latter-day Saints.
But, well, for
you know what I mean? There's like two.
I think for me personally, I wouldn't like that version of it to look at something every day because that.
Too much pressure to me.
I put so much pressure on myself in general that like seeing like it's a version of looking at a failure.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, oh, I didn't do that. I'm an idiot.
I think for years I was kind of like, I would look at it. I would kind of have some affirmations. I would be like, this is the way to kind of get me mentally. I also am a tinkerer.
Yeah,
I like to fuck around with stuff. I'm always like, I don't mind new agey, weird, cosmic shit. I'll try everything. And I think it's like,
is that why you're wearing those crystals?
Yeah. These aren't my eyes.
Okay.
Oh, no. Yeah, man.
Oh my God. That's beautiful.
Yeah, these are my eyes.
Oh, those are horrific.
They're very bad, but the crystals are helping. No, I just try stuff out. But I think for a long time I was like looking at shit every day, and now I'm more adopting the like, put it away.
Well, I think to me, what I've realized is helpful is like, for instance, I'm saying this because nothing might ever happen with this, but I just finished working on a book proposal.
Cool.
And for a humor book.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny, but and I like it. And well, that's that one. No, but and
great, but book.
It's so good. But like, I basically, even when I wasn't working on it, I would tell people about it, which I used to be really almost like scared or like superstitious about mentioning ideas, because like, what if, or like, I need to keep it to my, but I've realized when I talk about a project that I am excited about, I change how I'm talking about it to people over time, or I grab onto what people are responsive to when I'm talking about it and realize, oh, that's like an aspect I didn't think about. And like, I'm no longer as like precious with things. And I feel like also just talking about it and thinking about it is work. Like, I feel like I can be like, oh, I worked on it today because I actually talked about it. Or like, I went on a walk with my dog and I was thinking about it and I wrote down two ideas, and like, that's work.
Yeah. And it's like getting it out there too. Also, like, you get to kind of workshop it a little bit when you're talking about it. You get to see people's initial response. I know a lot of people in LA are like, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
But like, you know,
well,
like,
I feel
when
like
people
with people
into,
with people that you trust and unless they're liars and they are. But I think it's good to just also, where I feel like, me personally, I assume you like, you as improv backgrounds, like you can bullshit enough when you're talking about it that you're like, oh, and this, and you're like, I haven't thought about that yet, but naturally
you're riffing at it.
Coming up with ideas on the spot is very, very helpful.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Are at any point in this, are you reaching out to anybody for externally?
My mental health stuff?
Yeah, when you're kind of going through some of that stuff, not to go back to it, when you're pushing and you're still dealing with certain aspects of it, are you... what are the things that you're doing to try to kind of push?
I mean,
are you actually reaching out to anybody?
Well, first of all, I mean, not that I'm anybody who should give advice on anything, but I definitely went to a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. I was on medication and also started seeing a therapist, which I think is very good.
Yeah.
And then, I also reached out to like all of my really, well, first of all, a bunch of people helped out beyond friends helped out and were very helpful and supportive. Gotcha. And then I reached out to like all of my closest friends just to sort of, I feel like they probably knew. I'm sure Meryl had told them. I don't remember a lot of, some stuff is a blur, but I remember talking to each of my like closest friends on the phone for like an hour, letting them know what happened, and like, they were very, and you know, other, you know, all my family and everything, but my friends, it was very nice to like people that I've known who, you know, could just listen and like talk to me about it, yeah, and talk about their own stuff and just also like laugh about aspects of it, yeah, too, of like, oh, that's funny. Like that was a funny part of the whole experience.
I was just wondering, does it make you like, and you're going, if you go into a room now or you're in a writer's room, mm-hmm, does it make you a little bit more open, or are you like, I went through some of this shit, yeah, well, I don't have anything to hide? I don't know. I'm just thinking, like, I mean, it was, does it help you at all in the room? Kind of
the one time I'm sure it's, I know it's come up since.
That might be a room. Weird question.
No, but I mean, there was I write for Search Party, and uh-huh, in the second season, which was the first season that I wrote for, mm-hmm, there was a storyline that,
yeah,
involved someone going to a mental hospital.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this is like, what happened to me.
Yeah.
So I brought it up in the room, and I was very, people were super like, not being a big deal about like, yeah, saying, yeah, nice, yeah, things. And then also it didn't become a thing where people were like,
yeah,
oh, hi, yeah, so yeah, oh, you know, but it was just a nice thing that people like, right, were responsive to, but not in a weird way. And I was like, oh, this fits and it helps that in the room. And it's a reference point that I'm not, you know, I don't think I'd mention it. I'm comfortable mentioning it. I wouldn't just bring it up for, yeah, like, well, when I was in a, yeah, mental hospital, but, yeah, you know, yeah, I feel like if it practically makes sense, like, yeah. And also, again, like so many people in this world of comedy have dealt with,
yeah,
if not this, something similar or something that they can relate to. So it's not, it makes sense to mention it.
What about in a, like, or in a writer's room, or is there certain aspects that make a good writer's room for you that make you feel like, oh man, I love like being here, or like this, there's a certain vibe going on that like really fosters good creativity? Is there something that you really look for? Like, what are some of the better,
I mean, I feel
aspects,
like,
of the,
I feel like, I mean, I will say that Search Party specifically is very good. Everyone is very, it's just very collaborative, and everyone is nice and caring, which I feel like for the most part in most writers' rooms,
yeah,
that is the case, at least that I've experienced. But like some rooms are, I've realized, like, I hear nightmare. I've worked on jobs where, yeah, I'm working from 10 a.m. to like 2 a.m. and I sort of can't do that anymore. Like, right, I can't. Right. And I have an excuse, which I also feel like it right, sort of bums me out, because, like, I mean, I worked on one job that has really long hours, and, mm-hmm, I worked on it again this, it's like a biannual thing, and I had to tell the guy who runs the show, who I'm very close with and is very responsive and who knew about this experience, but I was like, I have to leave the room when I have to go, and I can't,
yeah,
stay super late anymore because of this. And
yeah,
it's, and I'm glad that people are respectful of it,
right,
but it's sort of, like, I know a lot of rooms do that, and yeah, I'm just like, I don't think I want to do that. Like, I don't think I can.
Right.
And it's hard. I mean, I'm sure if I was in that situation, I would, for a long amount of time, right, I'd have to figure out, like, I wouldn't want it to jeopardize a job. Like, if, yeah, it was like a dream job, but I'm also like, I prefer that's not a long-term thing. Yeah. And I feel like if I'm confronted with that, it will have to be a discussion where I would have to figure out, how do I make this as healthy as possible? Because sleep is really important, yeah, for multiple reasons for me and for everyone. It's
well,
like,
some of those rooms, I think, well, at least what I heard, like, if it makes sense for that room, for some reason, the vibe,
yeah,
you go,
yeah,
later, it's, yeah, just deadline it. Stuff that makes sense. But I hear a lot of rooms, it's like, doesn't make sense, or it's like,
yeah,
showrunner doesn't want to go home kind of thing.
And yeah, like, I think it's like, oh, every room is different, but yeah, it's like, yeah,
I think it would be easier than for you, maybe, if it made sense why you're staying late. If,
yes,
you,
yeah, 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 for sure,
then,
for sure.
Then being like, we don't have to do this.
Yeah,
why are we starting this late?
It's hard. It's, yeah, just that's the way some people work, and I, yeah, get it.
Yeah,
but
and it's a job. You're getting paid. Exactly. You understand, but it's like there's people have lives. And,
but I feel like that's something that I learned from this too. Is, mm-hmm, like to have a life outside, mm-hmm, of it, and not put everything on the work, like, right, not like
put all your everything that you,
yeah, your self-worth and, yeah, your self-worth and like I get it, and I'm not gonna say like I don't,
mm-hmm,
like I'm happier generally, I would say, when I'm working than when I'm not. And, yeah. But I've been trying to do a better job of being like, everything doesn't ride on these jobs, and it's good to have a healthy life outside of it, because that is your life. Like, right. The jobs will come and go, but like your sanity,
yeah,
and general health is the long-term thing. And yeah, it's good to sort of create boundaries and like remember, like, you know,
yeah,
it's, there are other things than one job or whatever.
But before you knew that, was there ever a point where you're like, I don't think I can do this anymore?
Do comedy?
Yeah.
I mean, I remember like literally sitting in my apartment after this all happened, trying to write an email to someone. Basically, I had written on another Triumph show. Robert Smigel did this election special.
Right.
And my wife had contacted him and been like, Craig has been going through this yeah, thing, and he won't be, because I was supposed to do some work for them.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, when I was back at my apartment afterwards, and a few days later, I was like, I know he's still writing and I want to reach out, and like, I'd like to keep submitting for this thing. Cause mm-hmm, I want, and I was like literally scared to sit down and write. I could not be, for many reasons, like, sit down and like start writing an email to someone, like a work email. Right. Like and this is someone that I've worked with before and I'm have a very good relationship with. And like, I was scared and I was like, oh my God, this is really scary to even. So I don't know if I was like questioning, can I do this? But I mean, I was like, getting back to being a functioning human being was hard.
Right.
And like, I don't know the timeline. I forget on that, but I did keep submitting for that. And Smigel was very nice.
Yeah.
As he always is. And then with this other thing, I like did a phone interview. This was the award show. And I was like, I don't know if I'm like not a full human being yet. And I have to be in a room with other people. And most of them I didn't know. And I was like, I just have to interact with, and like literally the week before I am an outpatient at a mental hospital, going to group meetings where you are literally going through a check-in that's like, are you suicidal? Mm-hmm. Are you think of harming yourself? Like, are you medically compliant with your medicine? Mm-hmm. Like answering basic functional questions about, are you able to
be a
human, being a functioning, self-sustaining person?
Right.
And interacting with people who are also similarly going through it, and no judgment, like also the spectrum from like coming down from like meth, like someone obviously like still high on drugs and in a meeting, to people who are self-harming, and like that's your experience. And then the next week being in a writer's room, and I was like, fuck, like I don't know. Like, it was just a mind fuck. Just,
What got you through it? Just time, or self-talk, or
I think just time support? And therapy and support and like, it was just humbling. I mean, was just like a lot of time. I mean, I still even like, even when I went, you know, and I missed work. I was supposed to shoot like 6 episodes of Your Pretty Face, and I missed that because of this, which is also like,
you're putting extra pressure on yourself.
I missed work. Work is like, these are people I work with. This is money involved. Yeah, and then like my friend Henry, who is the star of that show, you know, I'm texting them and people are being very supportive on the show. Everybody is being very supportive, but he's like, yeah, if you can, you should come out and film the last episode. And I'm literally like, I can't even like, my wife is afraid to let me walk around the block by myself. Like that's where I am at.
Yeah.
Like that's not like, there's just, so it took a long time.
Things like that would kill you probably in the moment, but at least you come to peace with some of that stuff where you go like, there's nothing I can do in that. Like when your health is like number one, it's amazing how the other things just seem like you care about them, but they seem much smaller than they used to.
Yeah. I guess. Oh, for sure.
Course, I'm sure you want to do that. And we talk, sometimes it comes up here, but like there is money issues that are here.
Yeah,
it's like,
of course,
we are our own boss. We are entrepreneurs. Like you said, we're trying to find the next job. So while you're trying to get over this stuff, there has to be like, God, this is my career.
Yeah. And I think in the short, like, I feel like I put that stuff aside. Like I even,
that's great. Yeah.
You know, like I was like to my wife, I was like, you know, like this job, I'm beating myself up, and she's like, it's okay. We'll get through. Everything's okay. We're fortunate. We're good. You know, everything's okay.
Yeah.
And like, and realizing having to be like putting myself first and, being like, I can't do this right now, or, I can do this, but I have to do my version of this. And just sort of reevaluating things and coming to a.
Cool, man. Thanks so much.
That's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool. It's pretty sweet.
Am I the worst interviewer or the second worst interviewer?
No, you're the worst. No, you're great. Well, it's so weird to talk about in general. Like it is like, it's fine.
I'm very grateful. Very happy that you talked about this. I feel like there's so many people that go through different versions of this, different levels of this that just feel alone. And this fucking city's crazy. This industry is fucking crazy. Yeah. And it's hard to, sometimes it is just hard to have a grasp on reality when you're you're not smoking weed.
Yeah.
You're not putting pressure on yourself. Sure. When you're functioning at a basic level, there's place is fucking bonkers and the news is bonkers.
Oh, everything's insane. Well, it's like, I feel like now I really do understand like just how people can crumble. Like it's like really like
it's like you said, it's humbling.
Yeah, it's really hard. And I feel I'm very lucky because I had like a really good support system. Yeah. But it's like this is hard. Like it's life is like things are weird. Like existence is strange.
Yeah.
And you can like your brain can make you do weird things.
You also
like,
got through it though.
Yes.
That's the other thing that you could kind of take away from it.
Yes. I feel like
you survived a very scary kind of
and I'm still working on it and it's good, but I'm like I do feel again like for, like we look back I look back at it as like I'm not glad it happened, but I am because it's like I did it. I survived it.
Well, thanks for sharing with us. This episode was brought to you by that bearded man.
Yeah, the chin beard delivering something that you wait, and you also explained that he usually you set it up that he delivers at 7:45, but like, I don't know. Is there a restaurant that delivers?
No. It's just one of those things where I did like a seamless thing. And it's like, we'll deliver. It's like, they give you the time, but they're never accurate. Any place I order from is just never accurate. So they're 3 hours later, or it's like 10 minutes. They're there. You're like, is this even real food? What the fuck's going on?
Write that guy to be on your podcast. That's an extra episode.
That's it. That's my bonus episode.
That's not a bad idea.
That's a good idea. I got to track him down.
Dude.
Follow the hair.
Dude.
Thanks, dude.
Thank you.
That was Craig Rowan. Thank you so much, Craig, for doing this, man. Guys, check out Craig's website, craigrowan.com. It's got videos. It's got the whole Please Give Me $1 Million documented series. Of course, as every episode of his podcast, it's that episode. You can also follow him at Craig Rowan on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Don Finelli or at The Need to Fail. You can email me, theneedtofail@gmail.com. Bonus episodes are at patreon.com/theneedtofail. You can call 657-222-1324. Leave me your failures. I will play them on this podcast. Please keep rating and reviewing the show on iTunes and Stitcher. So close to 150 for the year. That's it for me here. All new failures are coming at you next week. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name's Don Finelli. Mahalo your dreams. And now, as promised, an exclusive clip from The Angel of Vine. Just a quick word of warning, the clip does include graphic content.
Hollywood, California. Not just the home of glitz and glamour, no. Beneath the limousines and mink coats lurks a dark underbelly of crime, narcotics, and yes, even murder. The Angel of Vine, a murder straight from the pages of a dime store thriller, has captured the minds and fueled the nightmares of the nation and baffled law enforcement in Los Angeles. And how could it not? the life of Marlene Marie Evans, just 23 years old with a burgeoning film career, ended tragically on March 19, 1956, in an empty parking lot just north of Hollywood Boulevard. Her body mutilated, her life cut short, and her killer still at large. And with numerous false confessions, countless individuals questioned, and no viable suspects on the horizon, will the Angel of Vine be one Hollywood tale to go without a third act? Only time will tell.
After my first interview with Beth and Phyllis, I reached out to a self-proclaimed expert in the case and asked him if he wouldn't mind meeting me at the scene where it all started.
David?
Yep.
Hey.
Hey, you Oscar?
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too. Yeah, thanks for meeting me here.
Of course. Hey, welcome to Dead Hollywood Tours. It's what I do, man. So, you want to know about Marlene Marie Evans, huh?
Mm-hmm.
The grisly unsolved murder of a young actress. The Angel, as they call her. Well, they found her right over there.
In that parking lot?
Yes, sir. Flayed and posed and angelic, staring at the heavens. You know what I find amazing is how many crazy theories people have about the murder.
How many? What, can you tell me one?
Sure. People love to latch onto the idea of a Southern California that they've heard about when it comes to cases like, I don't know, the Manson family or the Zodiac Killer. Everyone wants to attach a half-naked wacko cult or a hooded madman whose MO is always somehow satanic rituals.
And you don't think that that was the case here?
No, absolutely not. The likelihood that Marlene Marie Evans was a sacrifice to a secret society is as plausible as the idea that she was murdered by the FBI, the CIA, and the mafia.
Interesting. How can you be sure?
Well, because of the care and the attention paid to her body. The ribs made to look like wings and the use of her spine to create a halo. I mean, it's all too clean, man. Too theatrical. It's too much of a presentation. I mean, I certainly don't think the killer had Ernie Newbern in mind as the dude that was going to find her. I mean, there's this laborer on his way to treat himself to some pancakes at Dupar's, and instead of staying on Yucca, which I would have done, takes the lot that cuts through from Ivar to Vine and finds himself an angel. No pancakes for Ernie that day. I mean, a construction worker. She was found by a freaking construction worker who panics, grabs every other worker on the job to confirm that what he's found is, in fact, a dead girl, and by the time the cops show up, it's a zoo. I mean, if you're going to lay a body across from an active construction site before dawn on a weekday, there's no question. She was absolutely meant to be found and seen by the public. I mean, once the press in this town got wind of the crime scene, they nearly destroyed any evidence in that lot trying to scoop each other. I mean, can you imagine trying to keep that lot safe from a mob of reporters? That's a ton of space to block off from vultures, let alone comb for evidence. With flashing bulbs going off and questions being yelled at that you don't have the answers to?
It must have been absolute mayhem.
Absolute mayhem. And Hollywood ate it up. I mean, not just Hollywood. Everyone ate it up. I'm still eating it up. I mean, have you heard those awful newsreels from back then?
I have, yes. Yeah, they're pretty colorful.
Colorful? They're grotesque. And, if you ask me, which you are, they only benefited the killer. The grandiosity of the drama on that scale of reporting just created more hysteria. Little known fact, where poor old Ernie found her in that parking lot, she was actually closer to Ivar. Marlene Marie Evans is actually the Angel of Ivar. But that's not as catchy, is it? So the reporters use Angel of Vine. Everybody knows Vine. Hollywood and Vine. Bang! Instant headline. Everybody's hooked.
My mother used to say all he cared about was that dead girl.
Meaning the angel.
That makes more sense now.
So what else can you tell me about Hank? We know he was a police officer. What?
My mother used to call him a professional peeping Tom. But yes, he was a cop for many years until he left the force.
Do you know why?
Something to do with politics within the department. They wanted to make an example of him, and so he left. After that, he opened his private detective agency, spends less and less time at home. My mother kicks him out.
Gigi was a tough cookie.
Understandable.
Can't say I blame her.
I said just a second. It's a damn rush. I'm in here. I'm not going anywhere. Yeah, how can I help you?
Hank Breeds.
That's what it says on the door.
May I sit?
That's what it's there for.
You come highly recommended, Mr. Briggs.
Oh, yeah?
Irwin was especially pleased with your discretion.
Irwin. You don't strike me as a Hollywood type.
I'd like you to help me find someone.
Now, you're going to have to be a little bit more specific.
Mr. Briggs, I want you to help me find whoever killed Marlene Marie Evans.
The Angel of Vine was a case with little to no information surrounding it. There were no prints, no clues, few suspects, and nothing connecting it to any other victims in any other cases. The investigation hit such a dead end that the entirety of the LAPD gave up after 8 months. Now, I want you to think about that for a second. The LAPD gave up any hope that they would catch Marlene Marie Evans' killer. And here we are, decades later, with an entire attic filled with audio recordings of an ex-cop turned private detective who got closer than anyone to solving the murder and didn't tell us all. I want to know what made Hank Briggs the guy for the job. I want to know how he found a trail that no one else could. And more than anything, I want to know if he can tell the world who killed the Angel of Vine.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.